Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Glucksmann Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. My name is Dr. Miriam Nyhan, and I will be your host on Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can tune in to us on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area and worldwide on www.irishradio.com. So whether you're here in New York City or in Ireland or somewhere else further afield, sit back and relax. Agus fáilte isteach. For those of you who don't already know, Glucksmann Ireland House is New York University's Centre for Irish and Irish American Studies. Inspired by the vision and philanthropy of Lewis L. Glucksmann and Loretta Brennan Glucksmann, Glucksmann Ireland House has evolved into a vibrant and world-renowned centre for the study of Ireland, Irish America, and the global Irish since its foundation in 1993. We're coming to you today from our home, which is an elegant townhouse at Washington Square Mews and Fifth Avenue in New York City's Greenwich Village. Today we're a little bit somber here at Glucksmann Ireland House because we're reflecting back on somebody who had an immense impact on the imagination, the penmanship, the poetry, the prose of Ireland and beyond over decades. Yes, folks, it's hard to believe it, but it is in fact 1 year since we lost Seamus Heaney. And I'm devoting a lot of today's program to discussion of Seamus, his work, his visits to us here at Glucksmann Ireland House. He was actually here at the opening on the 26th of April 1993, and we had the pleasure of having him here just a few months before he passed away in February 2013. And I will talk to my colleague Anne Solari a little bit later to get a sense of what's coming up over the next few months here at Glucksmann Ireland House NYU. We have a pretty packed schedule of public events programming, and we'd like to get the ball rolling and make sure people know about things nice and early, so we'll have a little bit more of a chat about that later on. But in terms of thinking about Seamus, I'd like to draw your attention to an event that we have coming up in collaboration with New York's annual First Irish Theatre Festival, which is a celebration of the best of Irish theatre brought to you by Origin Theatre Company. And we're always delighted to work with Origin Theatre Company and George Heslin in this collaboration. Throughout September, this festival highlights performances from playwrights old and new throughout the city. And as part of this programme of the First Irish Theatre Festival and co-programming with Glucksmann Ireland House NYU, I'd like to draw your attention to Seamus Heaney and Dermot Healy, A Celebration. In the past year, two of Ireland's most respected writers, Seamus Heaney and Dermot Healy, left us. And we have a unique opportunity to pay tribute and present an evening of two award-winning documentaries for the first time in the United States on Friday, September 19th at 7 p.m. The first one is Seamus Heaney Postscript, and this won an Irish Film and Television Award for Best Factual TV Program as an episode of Email, directed by Maggie Bratnach and Pascal Cassidy. And the second screening that evening will be of The Writing in the Sky, which is about the life of the writer Dermot Healy, who Seamus Heaney once called himself the heir to Patrick Kavanagh. The Writing in the Sky won an Irish Film and Television Award for Best Director and Best Sound and was directed by Gary Kane. So these events will take place at NYU's Cantor Film Center, which is just around the corner from us here on 36th East 8th Street between University Place and Broadway. This will be a ticketed event, so I'd encourage you to check our webpage after Labor Day if you'd like to purchase your tickets. They're only $10. There is free admission for members of Glucksmann Ireland House NYU and to all students and faculty with a valid NYU ID card. If you'd like further information about this, do consult our website at www.irelandhouse.fas, as in Faculty of Arts and Science, .nyu.edu. I'll give that to you again. It's a bit of a mouthful. That's www.irelandhouse, www.fas.nyu.edu or give us a call on 212-998-3950. So, as I mentioned earlier, for today's programme, a lot of it we're going to devote to the memory of Seamus Heaney. And we're going to talk to some special people here at Luxman Ireland House to give us some perspective. We're going to talk to the co-founder of Luxman Ireland House, Loretta Brennan Luxman, and we will talk to faculty member Professor John Waters, Professor of Literature in Irish Studies and the Department of English here at New York University and Luxman Ireland House. In September 2011, here at Luxman Ireland House, NYU, we had the pleasure of hosting Seamus and Mary Heaney as they came to celebrate the inauguration of the Tom Quinlan Lecture in Poetry. This lecture series was named for Philadelphia educator and lifelong lover of poetry, Tom Quinlan, and was endowed by his son and daughter-in-law, Joe and Mary Lou Quinlan. That evening, Tom, who has spent 60 years teaching literature and trying to pass on his passion and interest in poetry to people in the Philadelphia educational system. It was a wonderful evening. Seamus was in great form, and even though he had not been invited to speak or we didn't put pressure on him to speak, at a certain point he wanted to take the microphone and make some comments. And this is what he said.
Just thought this was much too meaningful and emotional to leave it like that. Having been here early on, it is a great pleasure to come back. And I was thinking of coming into the Glucksmann field of force here. We've all been affected by it, and the better for it. So I was asking Mary before we came, could she help me with this stanza of W.B. Yeats? Maybe Tom could. Yeats writing with Lady Gregory and the house where they were in Coole Park, and where so much took place and so many people were attracted into a kind of energy that was common and purposeful, rather like this. What's this? I've forgotten how it starts. It came like swallows, and like swallows went. Yet one woman's powerful character could keep a swallow to its first intent. And half a dozen in formation there, the dum-de-dum-de-dum-de-dum-de-dum, earned certainty upon the dreaming air. The intellectual sweetness of those lines that cross through, that cut through time or cross it with her shins. The intellectual sweetness of the lines that cross through time are very evident here, and the affection of this family and their generosity is exemplary. Tom will know that having a lecture named after you gives you the uneasy feeling, should I go to it or not? I find myself in that situation myself. Joe Lee gave a lecture about me recently, and in a series called Seamus Heaney Lectures. and there were eight considerable persons of the literary and intellectual world of Ireland contributing to this, and I thought it would be an insult if I don't go, but Christ, if I go it's going to be far worse. Sitting opposite of him. Anyway, the other thing I remember about names of things, Brian Friedel, I've got a couple of things named for me. Like Friedel and myself, Brian Friedel and myself have had routes, streets named for us in somewhere outside Derry. And there's a Brian Friedel Street and a Haney Street. And Brian said, well, mine's going to be a cul-de-sac, he said. So, I was thinking mine probably would end up with a a roundabout or rotary at the end. They also had a pub name for me in Rome.
Rome.
Yeah, and we went to it. I don't know whether it's still, the name's still on it or not. It was a kind of Guinness franchise, I think, it was supplied. But for the prize also, I was very grateful for the commitment to the Poetry Prize in Queen's. And to have that Queen's NYU connection is terrific. A first book is very important in any writer's life. It changes the sense of self. It promises and it tests the future for you. So a first book, getting a prize, is a very important, meaningful thing in that writer's life. And as Tom said so powerfully, changes things, changes the world. I myself must report, and I'll finish now, when I got a certain prize, I was full of unease. Christ, James Joyce didn't get this prize. You know. Look, Samuel Beckett got it. Yates got it. What am I going to do? And I went up home to County Derry, and everything was soothed a bit for me when our neighbour, Billy Steele, a local farmer, asked me a simple question. He said, congratulations on the winnings, Seamus. Here's to the people who supply the winnings.
One person who was key to Seamus's interest in Irish studies and in what we were doing here at NYU is the co-founder of Luxman Ireland House, Loretta Brennan Luxman, who is here with me today. We're honoured and delighted to have an opportunity to speak to her. And perhaps we can start off by getting a sense of how you and the late Lou first got to know this great man.
Gosh, thanks, Miriam. First of all, thank you for asking me. This is a very difficult and a very necessary conversation to have given the time that's in it, which is hard to believe. It's a year since Seamus has been gone over, and so many aspects of how we miss him, not why, because we all know why. But Lou and I, it's sort of lost in the mists of all the excitement of when we first were starting what Lou used to call our great Irish adventure. And of course, if you were active in Ireland, you knew who Seamus Heaney was. If you were active in the world, you knew who Seamus Heaney was. So we came upon him on a personal level, though, first through the good offices of Peter Fallon, who is a wonderful poet in his own right and a dear friend of Seamus's, and I think one of his closest proteges. Actually, Peter and Seamus were both mentor and protege, one to the other, in varying stages of their careers, but so close and so loving. So Peter and Joan introduced us very early on, and it would have been the very early 90s. And then we would come upon Mari and Seamus at various Irish occasions, sometimes in New York, sometimes in Europe, and lots of times in Ireland. And it became clear that both Seamus and Lou had this proclivity when they were in a new city, particularly, to sneak away and find out the bookstores. That was the first thing, what the bookshops were like. This is how they graded a city. But the second stop on their search, on their second very major criteria, was hardware stores. They shared a passion for hardware stores. And I just always found that so interesting and unique about both of them. So our friendship goes back chronologically to the very early part of when we were going to Ireland, late 80s to early 90s. But I think when we became really close friends was after Seamus won the Nobel and he accepted, he was inundated, as you might imagine, with offers of honors of varying guises, and he accepted an honorary doctorate at the University of Limerick, and Lou and I were very involved at Limerick at the time. And he and Mari came down for that, really just coming away from the high celebrations in Sweden. And Mari forgot her fancy dress that she had worn to the Nobel conferring, and of course she wanted that for this other very spiffy occasion. So we scrambled around, and I got a dress that I thought she would look fabulous in. She got dresses from half of County Limerick that day. And, of course, she looked smashing. I forget whose dress she wore, but she looked fantastic. And we had so much fun laughing about that. And just the friendship continued, and we were blessed.
So would you have spoken to him, or would you and Lou have spoken to him a lot, Loretta, about your ideas behind forming Glucksmann Ireland House?
Oh, yeah. Gosh, yeah. When we went over, Lou and I had been talking about the idea of an Irish center in New York for a few months, almost a year probably. And then Jay Oliva, who was president of NYU at the time and had the great good fortune to have an Irish mother. And God, you know, Miriam, I can't believe it. Jay is gone now,
yeah,
too.
Yeah.
Wow. Goes too fast. So Jay and Mary Ellen, both of whom had Irish ethnicity, and Lou and I, the three Irishmen and the one Hungarian Jew, went to Ireland on this informational tour. We visited all the university colleges, the National
University of Ireland.
Yeah, yeah, that. So we went from Cork all the way up to Galway, and had not a discouraging word from anybody. They were all very open to the idea. And we weren't asking for anything. It's no heavy lifting, just an open door and the prospect of cooperation. So that was in 1990. And one of the people that we talked to ongoing was Seamus. And he, of course, had wonderful ideas. He knew Dennis Donahue, of course, who was one of our mainstays. And Dennis, of course, was very helpful in the planning of it also. So, yes, a lot of Seamus's input has come to fruition,
mm-hmm.
like the archives,
mm-hmm.
the oral histories. And it wasn't only Seamus, of course, but he saw the value in that, capturing those stories.
Essentially, then, you get to know him in the aftermath, then, of the Nobel. I mean, from your interactions with him, Loretta, that really put him into a different stratosphere in terms mm-hmm. of recognition outside of Ireland, etc., yeah.
Oh, it was not only a game changer, it was a life changer. The thing about Seamus that someone much better than I at use of the language, someone like Peter Fallon or Paul Muldoon, one day will capture what was different about Seamus, because for sure he was different. He was a superb poet. He was a beautiful essayist. His prose, I always thought, was as lyrical as any of his poetry. But it wasn't just that. He was so beloved, and there was an aspect to his personality that was so open and approachable that no one felt remiss in just saying, "How are you doing, Seamus?"
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he loved that. There were no barriers to Seamus. He was so open and took it all in. I mean, one of the things I still remember is the notice in the New York Times on the day of his death. The front page, mm-hmm. above the fold, banner across the front page of the New York Times. When does that happen with a poet
mm-hmm.
from Ireland?
Mm-hmm.
And it happened with Seamus, because he just captured everybody's, not just their intellect, he captured their hearts. He was just a unique human being. And of course, again, he had the great good sense to marry the absolute right woman for him. She is just as strong and as brilliant and as giving as Seamus ever was. And Mari Heaney is well able to carry that monumentous banner for that family.
In a lot of his poetry, either explicitly and in a much more nuanced ways, implicitly, you know, things to do with identity and topics that really speak to people outside of Ireland mm-hmm. as much as they do. So, you know, when we're looking at things here, we're often looking at through the lens of Irish America or the global Irish community. It speaks to how his poetry transcended, you know, transcended mm-hmm. Ireland in that sense, and how Irish Americans or people outside of boundaries of Ireland and the borders, and using that word in the widest sense,
mm-hmm.
could engage with it.
I think that's so true. And Seamus was just in every piece of his DNA, in the marrow of his bones, he was Irish. And proud, but also open to all the introspection that he gave to what it means to be Irish and what does that say to the rest of the world. But he used that in such a humanistic way that it wasn't tribal, the way a lot of ethnic writers, particularly poets, are very tribal and therefore somewhat limited. There were no limitations to him. And I often think about what part of his beautiful brain led him to Beowulf. Mm-hmm. And that gorgeous translation. He always said that was a turning point in his career when he really, because you can't do Beowulf a little bit. It's you either do it or you don't bother. And boy, did he do it. His mind was just so open that he was Irish, and for sure he had an Irish mind and certainly an Irish soul, but he didn't see that as confined. Mm-hmm. He wanted to make that universal, and I think he for sure did.
Do you have any sense, Loretta, as to how, just again in keeping with the lens through which we engage with Irish studies here at Luxman Ireland House and more generally in the field of Irish studies, say outside of Ireland and actually in Ireland as well, do you have any sense of how he saw the diaspora or the people born outside Ireland or his views of Irish America? Did you ever get any sense of how he saw those things?
Oh, yes, in very many different conversations and also conversations that he had had with, particularly with Peter Fallon. I'm more privileged to know about those conversations because I have the great blessing of having Peter's friendship also. But he was a big, I often think in many ways he considered himself a member of the diaspora. He was always onward and outward looking, and he loved to travel. They both, himself and Mari, loved to travel, as you can see just from looking back on their lives. He saw the Irish abroad as certainly an extension of Ireland, but also as the most potential enriching of Ireland. He was very well aware of the danger of becoming inward looking. And that has happened to Ireland so often because we're a tiny little island and it's so easy to pull down the shutters. That was never a potential for Seamus. And he saw the people who had gone before as very brave and as benefiting the people who came after. And he spent all that time at Harvard, mm-hmm. and had that wonderful, glorious period. But what a lot of us forget is his first time, I think it was his first time, as a scholar in the United States was in California at Berkeley in the roaring 60s, right. and early 70s. And he was so energized by that experience. And it formed both himself and Mari in many, many ways. He benefited from that so much. So he saw Irish America as almost a catalyst for the leap forward that Ireland would make, that Seamus was very sure would happen. He saw the emigrants that had gone out before as the rich ingredient that we needed to make that happen.
Do you know, Loretta, did he like coming to New York City?
Oh, he loved it. He loved it. He just felt energized, and he was an energy junkie. He was easily energized by the situations around him, and he sort of was a sponge. He took it all in. Both himself and Mari loved New York.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I imagine the creativity of a place like New York City with the density of population and everything.
Excuse me, Miriam, but to be fair, they did love Boston. I have to tell all our friends in Boston, I'm not claiming them solely. They loved Boston. They loved their years there. And I don't know of any time when they had the luxury of time that they would make a trip to the United States that they didn't carve in some time in Boston.
Right. We had the great pleasure, and now it's so poignant, when we celebrated the 20th anniversary of Luxman Ireland House last year, you yourself were the honoree at our lovely first gala and 20th anniversary gala. Seamus and Mari were over for it. Little did we know how special a visit it would be for us, given that he passed away some few months later. Was it difficult to get him over for that, Loretta, last year?
Not a bit. I mean, the only difficulty that they always had was the calendar, as Mari would say, the damn calendar, which we can understand what that must have been like. He was so beloved and he was so respected throughout the world that everyone wanted a bit of him. When they realized that they could work it out as far as the calendar dictated, they were very enthusiastic because, as you said, from the very beginning he was involved, and he was here at our wonderful opening 21, almost 22 years ago now, good Lord, when we paraded across the square and everybody in their bib and tucker, and it was just fabulous. And he had such a good time because a lot of his pals were there. Cyril Cusack and
Brian Friel was
Brian was there, who's one of his dearest friends. Brian was at the funeral, and Brian's health is very fragile. Brian came to what I like to think of as the real funeral in Ballaghy, which is Seamus's home place in Northern Ireland. And Brian and Anne were there, and that was very, very poignant. So anyway, Seamus was with us at the opening, and it was just so glorious that he could say yes to come for the 20th celebration.
I mentioned this to you earlier before we started chatting more formally, and I watched from here the coverage of Seamus's funeral and death, and you've touched on it in terms of the banner mm-hmm. in the New York Times. I kept the copy of that newspaper
Good.
Because I too was so struck by it. Can you bring me back last summer to getting the news? Because we didn't expect him to go so
good
suddenly.
God, no. Colin McCann, another one of our treasures, the wonderful Irish American, well, he's Irish, but we claim him. He was called, Colin was called on the Friday morning at about 7 a.m. New York time by RTE, who was doing, they were doing reactions from writers on Seamus's death. I got a call from Colm right after he talked to RTE, and Colm's the one that told me. And that I've always been grateful for, because there's no way to assuage the almost physical blow that it was, so painful and so unexpected. But Colm talked, and he's a beautiful soul. And so we realized that this is reality and started to plan for what to do. And I was able to get on a flight that evening. Colm was not, for a lot of reasons with family, and so he was not able to come over. Then right after I spoke to Colm, I called Peter Fallon. Seamus had been at dinner with Peter on the Thursday night before he died, and it was their weekly routine when they could manage it. They had dinner together once a week. And Seamus was not unwell at all. And a lot of the news accounts said that he fell down as they were leaving the restaurant, which was right going into Donnybrook in Dublin. And he did not actually fall down. He slipped and lost his balance. Peter's arm caught him. But in any event, as Peter said, I know my pay grade and I do not go above it. He said, so I wasn't making any decision at that dinner. I called Mari immediately. And so they got him right into hospital, and then he died on the next day. I was able to get over, and so the big funeral in the cathedral, I'll never tell you the name of it. It's, I'm sure, in all the archives.
It was the church in Donnybrook, right?
I believe so,
yeah. I mean, you wouldn't have missed that funeral, Loretta. It was coming into a holiday weekend here in New York. It was Labor Day weekend.
I mean,
that was just instinctive to you.
It was very much the same as when Lou had died. I mean, you just go. Mm-hmm. There's no question. And the church was packed, of course. It was a bright, beautiful, sunny day in Dublin. The end of sort of spotty summer, but this day the sun shone. And God bless Peter and Joan Fallon. They collected me in the morning at the hotel and took me with them. And, of course, Peter was scheduled to read at the funeral. So I was seated with Peter and Joan in one of the pews quite at the front. And Edge and Bono and the guys were seated in the next row in back of us, and all kinds of friends were around. And it was just so otherworldly. You go into that zone where you know you've got to get through this. And everybody is sort of feeling the same way, which is a huge comfort. That was an amazing experience to see all the people from across Ireland. The Taoiseach was there and the Tánaiste. And Peter did speak, and he spoke beautifully. And Paul Muldoon spoke. Paul also had come in that morning from the States, and he came in through Belfast. And I'm sure a lot of our listeners have heard this, what Paul said, because it still moves me today. He said, I came in and the man at the immigration in Belfast said, and what do you do? And Paul said, I'm a poet. And the man looked at him and paused for a long minute and he said, you must be devastated. And that's all Paul had to say. Mm-hmm. I mean, the way the world felt, it felt devastated. Mm-hmm. And a man on the immigration desk in Belfast knew that. So we left Dublin then and drove, again, God bless Peter Fallon. I went to sleep in the back seat, and Joan and Peter got us to Balahi. And it was the first time I'd ever attended a real Irish funeral in a small village. And it was like every, not hokey film, but every true film you've ever seen. All the shops were closed, and the shop owners standing on the pathway. And they carried his casket through the town, which was maybe three squares. And we got up to the graveyard, and there were a few people standing around, and among them, Brian and Anne Friel. It was a very otherworldly experience. And I've never seen anyone as strong and dignified as Mari Heaney was that day. And the kids, they were all just magnificent. And his coffin was lowered into the ground, and that beloved piece of earth that he wrote about so beautifully. And I did feel closure. I felt something was all right. He was full circle, and where he always knew he would go. Fortunately, it happened way too soon.
Is it an amazing thing to say, Loretta, that someone of his stature and status and fame could have this traditional Irish funeral?
But that's who he was, Miriam. Mm-hmm. That's what made people drawn to him, because of that realness, that genuine, this is who I am. There were no airs. There was nothing false about Seamus. And he always knew he would come back to Balahi. Mm-hmm. From some of those early poems, when I read them now, I just weep. And they're not sad, or they weren't sad. One of my favorites was always about the peeling the potatoes. Mm-hmm. And when I read that now, when I really think I need a good cry, I can always get it from that beautiful poem. Yeah.
The aftermath and the reaction to Seamus's funeral, Loretta, and I know you're plugged in to, maybe you came straight back after Balahi.
I had to.
I know you've heard about, and you've a sense of what you touched on with Paul Muldoon's interaction with the guy on immigration, how his death and passing permeated every level of Irish society, and poetry and the stuff of academia, the stuff of his life can be so elitist, and he wasn't like that, and you could see it in his death. It was amazing.
It truly was. You know, everything you go to say about it seems like a cliche, because it is a cliche.
Yeah.
But cliches become available because they're so true. Everyone felt they had some part of Seamus, like the proverbial Dublin taxi drivers. Mm-hmm. Around that time, you could not get into a taxi without hearing the guy's experience with the Seamus. And that's what he loved, and that's what made him so special.
Mm-hmm. Again, to go back to our perspective here at Luxman Ireland House, all of a sudden his passing made his presence with us at the gala so special. And also, something I'd like to mention, I'm sure it's a development you were happy about as well, the relationship between Luxman Ireland House NYU now and the Seamus Heaney Prize for Poetry out of Queens.
Yeah. That's another one of his many legacies, is that prize in poetry at Queens. And now, because of Joe and Mary Lou, and particularly Tom Quinlan, we have the link here with NYU and Glucksman Ireland House.
Yeah, we were so disappointed, obviously, for the family, for his friends, for the world generally, for poetry, at the loss of Seamus, but in particular here for us, as you know, Loretta. We had anticipated he'd come for the spring just past, And he'd also as well agreed to sit down and start recording oral histories with us. So it's, at the very least, we're very happy to have the link through the Quinlan's and the Seamus Heaney Prize, and look forward to welcoming the poet Tara Bergen, is her name. She'll be here later in the year, and we'll celebrate that, and I'm sure raise a toast to Seamus.
Absolutely.
Well, listen, Loretta, and thank you for being so generous with your time and your spirit and your memories. I know that, as you said, it's a difficult thing to talk about, and it's hard to believe it's a year, but we didn't want to let the opportunity pass without marking this special day, the first year since he passed away. You know, in the Irish tradition, especially that first anniversary of a death is significant, and it's lovely to have the opportunity to hear your perspectives and to be so candid.
If I may, Miriam, when I used to be chair of the American Ireland Fund, and they got so weary of me saying, "May I have a point of personal privilege, please?" And eyes would roll all over the place. But anyway, I would like to just have a moment to thank you, first of all, not only for this wonderful opportunity to celebrate Seamus and Mari and everything that Heaneys have done for the world, but also to thank you for this opportunity to use this wonderful medium of radio, which is my favorite of all the techie things we have going on today. I love radio because it's so intimate, and the people that are bound together by radio, I always find, are much more cohesive in many ways. So what Adrian and Onya started so long ago, the fact that they have allowed us, Ireland House, to take a chapter of that wonderful history, but it wouldn't have happened if you, Miriam Nyam, had not grasped the opportunity and run with it. And I know you have so many other things that you are responsible for here at the house. Among them, our wonderful master's program, and there are a lot of bright young people, some not so young, which I love, demanding your attention for a very important part of their lives. And the fact that you have done this radio, you have made it possible for it to be part of Ireland House now. I can't tell you the importance of that and how much I thank you.
Well, the thanks is to you, Loretta. Thank you so much, and it was lovely talking to you today. We've had an opportunity to hear Loretta's lovely reflections on her relationship and friendship with Seamus. And now I would like to take the opportunity to get the perspective of somebody who intellectually had quite a bit of contact with Seamus and his work. That is our Director of Graduate and Undergraduate Studies, Professor John Waters, who is an Assistant Professor of Irish Studies and is affiliated with the English Department here at NYU. John, thanks for sitting down with me today. Maybe you can shed some light on how you, in your teaching and in your research, engaged with the poetry of Seamus Heaney and the man.
Sure, Marian. Thanks very much. It's a real pleasure and an honour to be able to talk about Seamus Heaney, who had an enormous impact on my life, and I think it's safe to say on the lives of almost everyone who works in Irish studies. I know that in the years since his untimely passing, I've had occasion to speak with quite a few people of my generation, and I've heard varying stories on the same theme of Seamus's generosity, kind acts, kind words of encouragement, and that he gave freely and, you know, without cost. He was an extraordinary poet, we all know, but we also know that he was an extraordinary human being. I really don't think I'd be here and doing what I'm doing if it were not for Seamus and for my encounter with him. I had the good fortune to be at Queen's University in Belfast in April for a commemorative conference and a series of events over 4 days that Kieran Carson and the Seamus Heaney Center at Queen's pulled together. There were 300 people in attendance, and I think every single person had a variation on Seamus's generosity and his buoyancy, his gift, his contribution to everyone's life. For me, that really began when I was an undergraduate at Johns Hopkins in the mid-80s, where I had the good fortune to study with a friend of Seamus's and a colleague of his later at Harvard. That's the South African poet and artist Peter Sacks. Peter was teaching a course that I enrolled in on contemporary British and American poetry. And being a South African, of course, that meant that he was free to include an Irish poet in contemporary British poetry. And we read from the collection of Seamus's first 4 volumes that was available then. And I wound up writing a paper for Peter on a poem of Seamus's that I later learned from Seamus was amongst his personal favorites, amongst his a few poems, of course, Digging would be one, and there are others that many of us would say Seamus Heaney held very close to himself. But I wrote a paper for Peter Sachs on the poem Personal Helicon, which I'd like to read in a second. But it's always been a treasured memory of mine that when I went to school at Trinity College in Dublin, I attended a reading of Seamus's at St. Patrick's College in Drumcondra, and I had my Faber and Faber copy of Seamus's Death of a Naturalist with me, and waited on a very long line of students getting autographs on slips of paper. And I asked if he would sign at the very end of the book as opposed to the first page at the bottom of Personal Helicon. And he paused for a moment and he looked at me and he winked and he said, "This is my favorite poem. I'm so glad you asked me to do this." And it's worth reading the poem. It's dedicated for his great friend and the great poet Michael Longley. This is Personal Helicon. As a child, they could not keep me from wells and old pumps with buckets and windlasses. I loved the dark drop, the trapped sky, the smells of waterweed, fungus, and dank moss. One in a brickyard with a rotted board top. I savored the rich crash when a bucket plummeted down at the end of a rope, so deep you saw no reflection in it. A shallow one under a dry stone ditch fructified like any aquarium. When you dragged out long roots from the soft mulch, a white face hovered over the bottom. Others had echoes, gave back your own call, with a clean new music in it. And one was scaresome, for there, out of ferns and tall foxgloves, a rat slapped across my reflection. Now, to pry into roots, to finger slime, to stare, big-eyed narcissus, into some spring is beneath all adult dignity. I rhyme to see myself, to set the darkness echoing. I think all the great themes that Seamus would explore over the course of his career as a writer are present in that poem. The relationship between surface and depth, the attempt to go underneath to get to the truth, the relationship between a reflection that is beauty but a reflection that also hides something important underneath. These are all enduringly powerful ideas in Seamus's poetry, and in a way I struggled to try to articulate what they meant for me as an undergraduate. And that paper for Peter Sachs led me to go on to study with Hugh Kenner, the great Irish literature scholar, and that ultimately led to my postgraduate degree at Trinity College, where although I read Seamus Heaney very passionately and closely under the tutelage of Terence Brown, great poetry scholar and modern Irish literature scholar at Trinity, I wound up writing my thesis on the poetry of Paul Muldoon, who was younger and different and challenging in a very different way. And after returning from Ireland, penniless, in need of a job and a place to stay, I wound up living in Cambridge on my sister's couch and exploiting her borrowing privileges at the Harvard Library, which she started teaching there. And Seamus had been teaching at Harvard for a year or two then, and I got up the nerve to just go visit him during his office hours. And he had not yet won the Nobel Prize, and although he was very highly regarded and well-loved at that time, his office was not the biggest office in the building. It was at the back of the actually converted house where the English department offices were. And I spent 45 minutes or an hour with him talking about Muldoon's poetry and the ideas I had about it. And again, the one word that comes to mind is generosity. He was noncommittal. Muldoon was tweaking him in a number of poems, particularly in The More a Man Has, The More a Man Wants, which I was writing about. I came away from that meeting with the idea that I knew I was onto something, and also that someone who was such an extraordinarily penetrating thinker had kind of given his blessing to the work that I was engaged on. And it was a year and a half later that I went off to graduate school to do my PhD at Duke, a place that was really dominated by literary and cultural theory at the time, and where my commitment to contemporary poetry gave me a kind of strength and purchase on something that was living and real and not abstract and not yet surrendered to theory, as it were. And I wound up studying British Romantic poetry for my PhD and writing on Keats and Wordsworth, and those two poets were very dear, very important to Seamus, particularly Wordsworth. There was a remarkable essay that Seamus published that was originally delivered as the first lecture in Grasmere, where Wordsworth lived and where the Wordsworth Center is based, the Pete Laver Memorial Lecture that Seamus delivered, I believe, in 1984. And it was published as a pamphlet that I bought in Dublin. And I brought it back with me and would thumb through it from time to time in graduate school. And I remember writing a paper for my PhD supervisor, Robert Gleckner, on book 5 of The Prelude of Wordsworth. And there was a passage that I have committed to memory, but it came to mind again when I was sitting downstairs in the basement of Luxman Ireland House with Seamus Heaney the night that we were announcing the Quinlan Family Lecture, and as well the tie-in to the Seamus Heaney Prize for Poetry at Queen's University Belfast, and the generosity of Joe Quinlan in establishing that link meant a great deal to Seamus, and he came especially to New York to be there for the announcement of that lecture. We managed, Seamus and I, to recall that first meeting that we had in 1987 in Cambridge, and to conversation that we then went on to have about these lines from Wordsworth's Prelude. And it's in Seamus's memory that I'd like to read these. And this comes from the very conclusion of Book 5 of the Prelude. "This only will I add, from hard experience and in humblest sense of modesty, that he who in his youth, a wanderer among the woods and fields, with living nature hath been intimate, not only in that raw, unpracticed time is stirred to ecstasy, as others are, by glittering verse, but he doth furthermore, in measure dealt out only to himself, receive enduring touches of deep joy from the great nature that exists in works of mighty poets. Visionary power attends upon the motion of the winds embodied in the mystery of words. There darkness makes abode, and all the host of shadowy things do work their changes there, as in a mansion like their proper home. Even forms and substances are circumfused by that transparent veil with light divine, and through the turnings intricate of verse, present themselves as objects recognized in flashes and with a glory scarce their own."
Thank you, John. That was lovely. While I have you here and we're thinking about Seamus, I was wondering if, in the context of your teaching here at Luxman Ireland House and the English department at NYU, and more generally in terms of your teaching exploits and delivering papers, what is it about Heaney, or is it unfair to kind of try and corner you on how he talks about identity and a sense of place and a sense of Irishness? I'd love, John, if our listeners could have the opportunity to think about Heaney in the context of how you might use him in a class setting, for example.
Well, we're about to start up a new semester, and my graduate seminar in the MA in Irish and Irish American Studies begins with a month-long consideration of the question of place and displacement in Irish cultural studies. And irony of ironies, that's the title, Place and Displacement in Recent Irish Poetry, of the Pete Laver Memorial Lecture that I was mentioning a moment ago. Seamus was obviously a man of the world and a global figure. I don't think there's any more globally recognized ambassador for literature and poetry in our time than Seamus Heaney was. But as everyone who thinks and reads and studies Seamus's writing knows, he's a farm boy from a very small place in County Derry. And knowing your place meant many things in his writing. Knowing your place is obviously a political statement about power and being a subject of another's power over you. But it's also a weapon to know where you are, to know the locality, to be more in tune with the local lore, the local gods, the local knowledge. And as a consequence, to know your place is to have a claim to it. And, you know, growing up in the six counties, Seamus had to deal with the question of what it meant to know his place and to overcome the ways in which he was told he should know his place. You know, in that sense, he is part of a remarkable generation that, after the Butler Education Act, got access to higher education in Ireland. And when the Labour government opened the doors to higher education, they seized the opportunity. And there's been wonderful documentaries and books written about what happened when a group that had formerly been excluded from third level education in Ireland got a chance to do it. St. Columb's, the only secondary school with two Nobel Prize winners in Seamus and John Hume. So identity for Seamus was a relatively uncomplicated issue. It wasn't something he felt he had to worry about. It wasn't something that in a contemporary kind of political sense he felt had to be bothered over. But I think being true to oneself and being true to one's place is what created identity, whatever it is. I always felt as an Irish American who was over and back quite a bit to Ireland that Seamus, like most Irish writers, recognized Ireland as a place that was bigger than itself, that included people outside of the island in its embrace. And I think Seamus' relationship to Irish America really testified to that very powerful idea that culture was bigger than the island and the culture traveled outside the island. And he was both the vehicle for that, but also the engine as well.
Thank you, John. It's a great opportunity to sit down with you on this sad occasion, but to hear your personal journey and interactions with him, and in light of what we've heard from Loretta, it's really nice to kind of share those stories. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Marian.
I'm here with my colleague, Anne Solari, who coordinates our calendar of public events for the fall. I'd like to take the opportunity to ask you in a little bit more detail about what's coming up over the next few weeks specifically, Anne.
With the new semester starting here, we're really excited to see all the undergraduate and graduate students coming in, and watching them take the Irish language courses here is a great inspiration for our upcoming Irish Language Day on Saturday, September 13th from 1 to 5 p.m. The public can come in for a free session. They can take beginners, intermediate, and advanced levels with our own NYU faculty, including Padraig O'Carroll, our senior language lecturer, as well as Hilary McSivna, our language teacher, and then Paul Ferris is one of our MA program alum, and then we have a new Fulbright foreign language teaching assistant just come to us from Ireland, Shane O'Rourke. So it'll be a great opportunity for our Irish language speakers to come and meet him as well.
Yeah, we had Paul in a few weeks ago talking about his research on the Irish in New Jersey, Paul Ferris, so it's great to see him still being active and participating in our Lá Gaeilge. You said that's free of charge, Anne?
It is free, yeah.
Great, that's fantastic. And later that evening, I see that we are hosting the Blasket Islander, Micheál Ócárna, Mike Carney. He'll be interviewed by Padraig O'Carroll, our senior Irish language lecturer, about his life on the Blasket Islands, on Blascaid Moor, and the island's 1953 evacuation, and his recent memoir, which he wrote in Springfield, Massachusetts, which has been his home for the last number of decades. And the memoir is called From the Great Blasket to America. He co-wrote that with his son-in-law, Jerry Hayes. That event will be in Irish, folks. If you want to avail of this wonderful opportunity to hear very uncorrupted, pure Irish from the Blaskets, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity in many ways. Michael will be 94 years of age in a few weeks' time, so this is a great opportunity. We're really excited to host him in the New York metropolitan area, I believe for the first time, so come along, folks. Tell us, Anne, I see that we have something on September 18th at 7 p.m. with the First Irish Theatre Festival. What's that all about?
The First Irish Theatre Festival is a tremendous undertaking which George Heslin and Origin Theatre have been putting together for the last 7 years. And it's running from September 3rd all the way to the 29th. And it has productions from Dublin, Belfast, LA, and of course New York. We've been participating all the way along. And last year we had a new play called Maybe by Jimmy Kirk. And that was a huge success. The house was overflowing, roaring with laughter. So we thought we would have him back again. And he has a new work with Geraldine Hughes, who many people know as the Belfast actress. You know, she's been in Gran Torino and so many beautiful pieces of her own. So they've come together. They have a new play called Four Women in a Boat, which I don't believe has been ever read publicly before. So another great opportunity to come into the house, hear another great play. It's about a group of friends and their golden years going on a cruise when their voyage becomes an unexpected journey of love, laughter, and tears with one very unexpected shipmate. So that's a great opportunity to see these great playwrights at work.
So I see we finish out September with musical events. Give us more of a sense of what's going on towards the end of September.
On Thursday, September 25th at 7 p.m., we're completely ecstatic to be welcoming the Dublin-born singer-songwriter Lisa Hannigan, whom some of us got to know as this beautiful accompaniment to Damien Rice. But she's really come out on her own. She has two acclaimed solo records, and we're just delighted to also be bringing her to a wider New York audience. Though, of course, she opened at MSG the other year, so I think there will be a lot of demand for that. The tickets are on sale online as opposed to the RSVP system that we may have for other events. So you should definitely, if you're interested in Lisa Hannigan on the 25th of September, should buy your tickets now because they shouldn't last. And that is being co-presented with the American Ireland Fund Young Leaders Program.
I see we have our first Blarney Star concert of the season on September 26th, Friday, September 26th at 8 p.m. Tell us a little bit about who's playing that night.
Well, we're so happy to be having fiddler Rose Flanagan and flute player Laura Byrne. And they're both amazing performers and also really excellent music teachers. So we'll get to see them doing their thing. They've won tons of competitions and have a new, or rather recent, debut recording, Forget Me Not, that showcases their exceptional technique and solidly traditional musical taste.
So September is an action-packed month here. Perhaps in a few weeks' time, Anne, we can have you back and hear more about what's going on in October.
There's a lot going on in October. We've got literature, film, history, music, and everything. So I look forward to coming back.
Great. And for people just to have on their radar, Irish Film New York will be coming up the first weekend in October.
Yeah, that'll come up quick. And the films do sell out. So if you're interested, we're honoring Jim Sheridan on the 25th anniversary of the release of My Left Foot. And Jim himself will be here at NYU to talk about his work. The festival takes place on Friday, October 3rd, 4th, and 5th. Jim's appearance is on the Saturday, and there's five contemporary new Irish films that people probably have not had the opportunity to see unless they've been back to Ireland this last year. So between Jim Sheridan and the new pieces, there's a lot to see there.
Right. If people want to join Luxman Ireland House NYU, Anne, what's the best way to do it?
I think the best way is the web. We've got membership form with credit card details on the web, but some people may feel more comfortable calling during business hours and we'll take your info over the phone. Or we can sure send you out a form and you can mail us back a check.
That's great. Listen, Anne, thanks for taking time out of your busy schedule to talk to us today.
Well, I'm happy to be here.
For those of you interested in the history of the Great Irish Famine, and any of you interested in Leitrim history, I'd like to draw your attention to an event which will take place on Sunday, September 7th. On that date, Dr. Maureen Murphy of Hofstra University will launch a new book by Dr. Gerard McItasney. The book is entitled The Dead Buried by the Dying, The Great Famine in Leitrim. This event will take place in the Manhattan Room at Rosie O'Grady's on 7th Avenue at 5 p.m. If you'd like some more information, please call 917-751-8154 or 914-693-8888. Gerard McItasney will have a number of events over those few days while he's in New York. He is the acclaimed author of some biographies on Tom Clark and Sean McDiarmida, and has also written some interesting work on the famine and poverty in Belfast, and has written several books on local history in County Leitrim. So we'd highly recommend that event. We're coming towards the end of the programme. I'm Dr. Miriam Nyhan, and I want to thank you for listening to the Luxman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. I'll be back again next Saturday, same time on WNYE 91.5 FM in the tri-state area, and on irishradio.com. In the meantime, if you'd like to get in touch with me or my co-producer, Jamie Sweeney, please email us at ireland.house@nyu.edu or call 212-998-3950. If you would like to hear this program again, please go to irishradio.com. Stay tuned for the Adrian Flanley Show up next on WVNJ 1160 AM. And for those of you listening on irishradio.com, stay with us until noon. Have a lovely weekend. Slán agus beannacht.